Welcome to the podcast of Data and Analytic in Business. We'll learn from the leading industry experts using data and analytics to solve the problems and create values in practice. We'll also learn where the industry is heading to and how data and analytics will shape the industry in the future. Most importantly, how they are preparing their business for digital transformation and disruption in the future. I'm your host, Jason Tan, and thank you for listening.
Good morning, Chris. Welcome to the Analytics Show podcast. And thank you so much for video conferencing all the way from Beirut, Lebanon. I'm excited to learn more about the AI and the data science, what is happening in this particular, especially in this region.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you for having me. I'm also excited to be here and to be able to share my story and my experience with your audience.
We'd love to hear your story. I think it is especially the story from this side of the region is something that I am dying to find out, and I'm sure that many listeners would want to know as well. Now, before I started, I know you have taken, I noticed that you have taken the role of Beirut Ambassador and Regional Lead at CT.AI as a volunteer work since 2017. Tell us a little bit more about this volunteering experience.
Yeah, so basically, I came across CT.AI, the community, back in 2017. I was actually, I just started doing some community work in Lebanon and building kind of a community around AI. And it happened that I was traveling to Amsterdam with a couple of friends, and I was looking for some meetups around artificial intelligence to kind of, you know, check out while I'm there. And I came across Amsterdam AI, and then basically they introduced me to CT.AI, which is a global community of AI chapters all over the place. And I immediately thought this is very exciting. It's a way for us to, you know, connect cities together. So I reached out to them. We had a chat, and I decided to kind of lead the Beirut AI community. So we opened up a chapter in Lebanon, and this started the journey of Beirut AI. And this has also, you know, led me to eventually founding Zaka.
Wow. So that is quite a story, especially how you found out about that whole thing just from your travel in Amsterdam. Do they have many of these do they have the equivalent one in Australia or other parts of the world?
Yeah, definitely. So CT.AI has, I think, around 70 chapters all over the world. Some of them are not as active as others. I do believe we have one in Melbourne, Australia, and one in Sydney, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm not sure how active they are at the moment. And basically, all over Europe, we have some in the US, and then Latin America, and Asia as well, and Africa. So, as I said, like 70 plus cities.
So, what do you guys try to achieve of this CT.AI, or especially what you try to do for the Beirut version of it?
So, the CT.AI basically goal is, you know, allowing everyone access to artificial intelligence. So basically just bringing people together to discuss AI, to share lessons learned, to, you know, share experiences and help each other where, you know, wherever it's possible. And so usually it depends from city to city. It's not like there's a fixed format, but usually cities would host different types of meetups or maybe workshops, and all in the effort of raising awareness on AI and helping, you know, more people understand and figure out what is this AI that, you know, we've been hearing about. How can this be useful for me in my business or in my project, or, you know, however I'd like to use it. And so it's really flexible format. It's not like it's fixed. Each city can do its own you know, type of event that works for that city, as long as it's kind of helping people get into AI and understanding the concept behind it.
So how is that different to the AI events that is already organized by any other organization or company, etc.?
I mean, it depends, right? It's a very broad question. So there are a lot of similarities. There's a lot of people organizing events around artificial intelligence because, as you know, it's a hype, right? Everyone is excited. Everyone is really interested to know more about AI. And so, I mean, it depends, again, from city to city. What we do, for example, in Beirut, we're focusing a lot on the technical aspect of AI. And so when we first started doing our events, because there's not a lot of traction in the region here, there's not a lot of companies working in AI and implementing AI. So everyone is interested, but no one's actually doing anything with it. And so when we started doing those technical workshops and helping developers apply artificial intelligence, you know, hands-on, this has gotten a lot of traction and a lot of excitement. And so we started doing a lot of educational workshops and events around artificial intelligence.
It seems like that is what also led you to decided to start the company called Zaka. Tell us a bit more, Jack, a little bit more about Zaka and your role as the founder and CEO at Zaka.
100%, Jason. So in fact, my journey started, you know, a bit before founding Beirut AI. So I was initially a software engineer. I've been working in tech for the last 12 years. And during my my first startup, which was around 8 years ago, I came across machine learning and artificial intelligence as a way to, we needed to add some, you know, capabilities to our product, and it had to use machine learning. And so I came across the field. I absolutely fell in love with how, you know, everything works in AI. And you know, after a couple of years, my startup did not make it. But you know, I had a passion for AI, and I really wanted to share this knowledge and, you know, my passion with other members. And it was around that time as well where I met City AI, and I decided to found the Beirut AI community. So as I said, we founded the community, and the whole idea was to push the AI ecosystem in Lebanon to have more people, you know, aware of AI and implementing artificial intelligence, you know. And so we started doing those meetups. We did, as I said, more of technical workshops, and because this is what the audience was asking for. So a lot of people were interested in AI, but they were asking us, like, how can I apply this? What should I do? How can I write code to build models that can, you know, do X or Y or Z? So we started doing workshops, and this is where I actually realized that there's a big need for people to really understand and apply AI from, you know, practically, not just listening to other people talking about AI, but actually understanding how they can implement it themselves. And so, and the same problem that we found in Lebanon was also found, you know, elsewhere in the region as well. So at that time, I was still working as a consultant on different AI projects, but I realized that I need to dedicate, you know, my full time on this mission of bringing AI to the MENA region, you know, through education. And this is why or when Zaka was born. So Zaka was born from the need of really pushing this community effort into kind of a bigger, broad mission and really helping the MENA region get into artificial intelligence. And when we say get into AI, we mean we want to see more AI adoption. We want to see more companies implementing AI and more individuals, more talent, you know, capable of building AI projects. We need local talent to be solving local problems. And that's basically the mission of Zaka, and that's what we've been doing for the last 3 years.
Just in case for the listener who are not familiar with the MENA region, would you like to quickly give a background explanation? What is MENA region and what other countries are in the MENA region?
Yeah, so basically the MENA stands for Middle East and North Africa. And so the countries including obviously Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, Oman, all the way to GCC, and also North Africa, like Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco. So the whole range of these countries. What we currently focus on at Zaka is basically more of the Gulf region at the moment. So we started in Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and right now we're, you know, reaching as well Qatar and Oman and Kuwait. And hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll also scale to the rest of the MENA region.
That is fascinating. Now, what do you hope to achieve for the AI community in the MENA region through your company at Zaka?
Well, we really hope that, you know, in the next couple of years, we can see a vibrant ecosystem here in the region. So we can see basically, as I said, more adoption of AI, more companies implementing AI in their products. We want to see local people solving local problems. And that's the beauty of AI. It's a technology, right? It's something, it's a tool that you can use to help you solve problems in an efficient, smart way. And each country and each region has its own unique set of problems. And that's why you need local people to be able to solve local problems, right? You cannot expect, you know, engineers sitting in, you know, let's say Silicon Valley to solve your problems because they have no idea what you're going through. And that's why we need local people, local skilled talent in artificial intelligence to be building solutions for the local market. And so ideally, we'd like to have this, you know, a vibrant ecosystem where, as I said, companies are implementing AI. There's a lot of opportunities. We have startups in AI. We have governments, you know, kind of pushing these initiatives. So that's the goal we're working towards.
I think that what you just mentioned about the local people for the local challenges is so, so important because you guys, the local people would have the context about the challenges. The local people would have the context about all the nuances of all those little things that the overseas foreigner may not necessarily have. And the best way is how to also, not more than that, is also how to build up the talent in serving the economy, how to build up the economy that you could enjoy like the Silicon Valley. So that is so important. I just want to give you a big shout out on that one.
100%. I totally agree.
Now, on that note, compared to countries like the United States and perhaps China or Europe, what are the challenges that the MENA region faced in spreading AI education?
So first of all, I do believe that this problem is not just in the MENA, it's globally. So education on AI is something that's needed everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, in the US and in China and in the more advanced developed countries, you have much more talent than you have, you know, in the region here, but it's still a global, there's a global shortage of talent when it comes to artificial intelligence and data science and, you know, the related topics. And so in terms of the challenges here, other than the talents, you also have challenges, for example, of data, because as you know, our AI depends a lot on data, on access to big data. And this is also something that the governments and the countries themselves should be kind of have a data culture or data mentality that allows them to, you know, unify the access to data and have, you know, open access to some information, because you need data to be able to build some, you know, useful ML products. So I would believe that the challenges are mainly access to talent, which, you know, we're hoping to change that. Also access to funding and access to opportunities, and maybe also government having some clear vision of, you know, like the AI strategy, which, by the way, many of the countries in the region have recently put an action or basically put a plan for their AI strategy. So if you look at, let's say, Saudi Arabia's vision, 2030 vision, or similar in Qatar as well. So you have some countries where they've actually stated we're interested in, you know, implementing AI in those, you know, aspects, and they have a clear vision, they have a clear mission, and, you know, they're working towards it. Also, if you look at the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, they do have a ministry of AI, and they do have, you know, it's much more developed than other countries. So one of the issues that is also found in the region is this basically difference or gap between, you know, some countries in the region are very advanced when it comes to implementing and adopting and pushing artificial intelligence, like example, the UAE and Saudi Arabia. And you have other countries who are still completely clueless of where we want to go and, you know, what's the next step and what is our vision. So there's this huge, you know, gap or difference. And it's something that I believe it's kind of unique to the region, as opposed to other regions where more or less you don't see this difference between the countries, right? They're more or less similar in the direction they're going. So I think this the challenges are going to be slowly faded away in the, you know, in the coming few years, because you know we're working towards that. Governments have started implementing not just planning a vision, but also upskilling, you know, capacity building, making sure that everyone is digital, you know, knowledgeable in digital skills, and you know, AI is one of the skills that are needed in the digital world.
Do you think the government of those countries who are well ahead, who are far more ahead in this journey compared to other countries within the region, what do you think is the key driver, or what is the thing that is helping them to push so much further in that journey?
I would say it's mainly two things. First of all, obviously, they have the vision, they have the willingness, that they see that this is the future and they're very interested in pushing towards that future. And second, obviously, having funds, having the capacity to actually invest, you know, money and resources to push their countries to go there. So it's a combination of, you know, willingness to go there and also the funds to enable that.
When you were talking about that, then I tried to understand more about MENA region. And first thing first that it came to my mind is the language. In terms of the spoken language, the written language, especially the written language, I can imagine, or at least from what I see, is that obviously the languages is different, right? And processing the language, the input output of the language, given that it's so vastly different, would you mind to educate me? Does it actually make your job in terms of the data storage, the processing of the data, understanding the data and structure and unstructure them in the table, does it actually make it more difficult? I mean, for example, if I were to think about Arabic, I'm trying to visualize that in my head. How exactly is being structured in the table? What does that mean? What is that? How is that like?
I mean, that's a great point, and I can't believe I missed that, but thank you for reminding me. As you said, like, the main language in the region is Arabic, and it's not the same Arabic, so there are different dialects from different countries, but it's mostly the same language. It's still Arabic. And if you combine all the different dialects, I would believe Arabic is like the second or the third most spoken language in the world, right? So there's a huge number of people that speak this language. But if you look on the AI, papers and the researchers and the tools that are out there, there is a very few limited ones that actually supports Arabic. So this is one of the issues that I told you about, where we need local people to be solving local problems. So that's one of them, right? So let's say if you're working on NLP, natural language processing, most of the resources out there, you'll find about the English language, because you know, most of the people working on them are, you know, people working in the US or in Europe or somewhere where English is the main language. And so we need to have more people, pushing Arabic or AI for the Arabic language. And it's happening. It's not like there's nothing out there, but it's not going as, you know, at the same pace where development for the English language is going there. And so if you want to build, let's say, a project using AI for NLP in English, it's very easy, more or less, to do it, because there's a lot of resources, there's a lot of libraries, there are examples. It's just easy to support it. Whereas when you go to the Arabic language, it's not as such. So to answer your questions, when you're dealing with the Arabic text, at the end of the day, you're not going to invent, you know, everything from scratch. You will be using some tools and some libraries that will make your life easy. And this is where it depends. So in some cases, you have tools that, you know, make your life much easier, so you can just use those. In other cases where those tools do not exist, then yes, it's a bit difficult, and you have to, you know, figure things out yourself. You have to kind of work around your challenges. So I would say, yes, the Arabic language is one of also the challenges that we have in the region to apply artificial intelligence.
Thank you so much for shedding some light in terms of the language. I think as you were explaining, it really got me thinking a lot. Say, for example, I actually can speak 4 or 5 languages, but then at the same time, I can't help but to think that, for example, there are so many other countries where English obviously is not the main language. What that equally mean is if the main language is not English and English is not the main media, is not the main language for the medium of exchange, and with another factor where if the population, that is not enough population to support that language, I feel like the education itself of translating the English literature in the AI in data science into that language where more people can be educated in that subject, it could be really difficult. I feel like that is almost like an instant barrier for some of the country that is already out there. I feel like perhaps the lucky thing, like you say, is Arabic is one of the most spoken language because it's spoken in so many countries. So I think it looks like at least you guys are safe from that.
Yeah, exactly. I'm aligned with what you're saying, and definitely having, you know, breaking this barrier to language is definitely gonna have a huge impact on who will be able to understand and apply AI. Because, you know, if you can understand the literature and if you can you know, benefit from the knowledge pool of all of the, you know, the papers and the libraries and all the work that has been done, then you can suddenly have democratization of the AI knowledge across different cultures and different countries. So definitely this would help to have, you know, access to the language.
Apart from language barrier, do you have any suggestion on how we can make AI education more accessible to the people in the MENA region?
So it's basically what we're focusing on, right? So it's providing the education, whether it's in form of just awareness sessions or it's more detailed, hands-on, applied workshops, whatever it is, I really believe that everyone, not just in the MENA region, but everyone should basically understand what artificial intelligence is, mainly because it's such a powerful tool that's affecting everyone's lives. And it's not something that only technical people, you know, should understand or should be aware of it. I believe just like the internet, like everyone uses the internet, whether they understand how it works or not, they are using the internet, right? Every time they send a message on their phone or they, I don't know, send an email, open Facebook or any social network, they're using the internet, right? So they should understand basic things. And I believe AI is a very powerful technology that is fueling a lot of the products that we are using, especially on the smartphone. And so again, I believe people should really basically have a clear understanding of what AI is, because there's a big misconception. So most people, when you tell them artificial intelligence, the first thing they hear or they think about are robots. They think, yes, they imagine a robot and they think, yeah, AI is robots, which is not exactly the case. AI is not robotics. Most of the AI we talk about today, you know, these are algorithms. This is machine learning or deep learning. And these algorithms are, you know, they're hidden. They're kind of, they're not visible as a robot. So people, when they tend not to see them, they tend to ignore them. And then you get basically the powerful ways that algorithms are currently kind of not controlling, but actually they have a huge impact on our lives, right? So when you open YouTube and you look at the recommendations, like this is an algorithm that's recommending a video for you to watch, and it can easily recommend, you know, different ways to get you into different things. Same thing when you go to on Netflix or you go to any other, you know, maybe e-commerce website, they're recommending things to you. This is all algorithm based. When you see an ad, you know, online, this ad is not randomly shown to you. It's actually looking at what Jason, let's say, is interested in, what, you know, who is Jason, who's that profile, trying to match you with ads that are relevant to you. And it's important to understand how they can make this, right? Because a lot of people think that, let's say that the Facebook is spying on them and they're listening to their conversations, and that's how they're able to show such targeted ads, which is not the case. It's actually Facebook have built a really good model on each person, and they can really understand, you know, what does Jason like and what is Jason interested in, and they can predict that, and they can show you things even before you maybe think about it. So it's definitely cool, but it's also a bit scary. And understanding how it works definitely helps, you know, to cope with the new world and the new way of living. So that's why, going back to my point, I believe everyone should understand what AI is, should understand how AI is affecting their industry. And this is something I tell all students, not just technical students, because, you know, I meet a lot of students through our workshops and through our webinars. And a lot of them are computer science and computer engineering students, so they are technical. And so they kind of are interested in AI, but I also meet others who are not, right? And I tell the others, like people coming from business and finance and marketing and whatever background they are, I tell them, you should understand AI and you should understand how this technology is affecting your industry. Because, you know, whatever your job is at the moment, in a couple of years, it's going to be altered by AI. It's going to be somehow using artificial intelligence in a way. And if you can really understand how this is going to change your industry, you can position yourself in a way that you don't get left behind, or your job doesn't get, let's say, automated or replaced. Because this is a huge, you know, fear around AI, the automation part and the job elimination, and what's going to happen to a lot of the jobs that are currently being automated. And so the answer to that is just figure out how your job is changing and change with it. Because AI is not going to completely replace a job. It's just going to change the way this job is done. It's going to allow whoever's doing that job to maybe focus more on the creative part and eliminate maybe the redundant, boring part, right? So it's going to be somehow changing the job. And if you understand how you can position yourself to take advantage and to be relevant in the job market, you know, in the future.
100% spot on, understanding how the circumstances and the landscape are changing and how to use that AI to complement what they do. I really like that man plus the machine philosophy. Now, there's one thing that I do want to ask you. I know you travel extensively in Europe and also in the MENA region. If you were to compare between the two, what is the unique thing about the AI community in the MENA region?
I mean, the most exciting thing I would say is how fast it's growing and how much people are really interested in you know, in applying and going into the field. So because maybe Europe or the European ecosystem is a bit more advanced than the ecosystem here, so people are it's not growing as fast as it's growing here. So people in the region, the MENA region, they're very interested, again, in understanding and pushing and, you know, going into the field, because there's a huge untapped potential here, right? So we suddenly realized that there's this huge, exciting opportunity that, you know, no one's actually been doing a lot of things in that space. So people are just rushing there, and, you know, I would believe it's growing really fast. So the next couple of years, you're going to see a whole different, you know, ecosystem here than it was earlier. And I would say this is the, if you want to compare them, I would say the growth rate is much higher here than in Europe.
Do you think the same language, which is Arabic language, plays a role in speeding that up, as opposed to multiple languages that the European would have to face?
I mean, maybe, but not entirely, because even though, you know, everyone speaks Arabic, as I said, there's different dialects. And so most of the discussion mostly happens in English and Arabic. It's mixed, right? So there's not just, not everyone speaking Arabic all the time. So usually it's done in English. And then there's also the casual discussions that are happening in Arabic. But Maybe, I mean, Arabic definitely does help because, you know, it links everyone with the same base, right? The same connection. So you know that you're talking to someone who shares a lot of the same culture that you share. But I wouldn't say exactly it's because of the language. I would say, again, it's because, you know, there's a lot of untapped potential. And there's a lot of, you know, things that can be leveraged, that can be done. So kind of like low-hanging fruits, and then kind of accelerates from there.
Can you see a world to where there are more collaboration in the AI between the MENA region or other parts of the world?
I hope so. I sure hope so, because collaboration is you know, definitely needed, right? It's always good to leverage each other's strength instead of kind of competing. So I would hope so. I have no idea how this will play out, but
any particular area of interest that you hope to see more of that happening?
I mean, my interest at the moment is education, and is really making sure that, you know, everyone again understands what this technology is. And it's very crucial, because having a digital nation, having people who, you know, understands how the basic concepts work would have a lot of effect in the future on a lot of things. So you start with educating, you know, the public around digital skills. AI is one of them. And then just give it a couple of years and you'll see, you know, amazing things happening.
On the note of the education, does the academy world, like the university in the MENA region, often have this sort of exchange program with other parts of the world, like US, Europe, and Asia, so that you guys can learn from each other?
Yes, I mean, of course, each university has its different affiliations and you know, training programs with other universities. But my issue with this is I don't believe that universities are really preparing the students for the job market. And I would say this not just in the region, I would say this almost globally. And it's not really the fault of the universities, but it's also because this field is moving at such a rapid pace that the universities and the curriculum cannot keep up, because you cannot really update the curriculum every 6 months, right? There's an accreditation process that takes a couple of years. There's a lot of things that, you know, so the way to update it is a bit slower than the actual market needs. And so what I would say is all the students would need to kind of bridge the gap. We need to get additional education. In addition to the university education, they need to get some practical hands-on education that really prepares them for the job market, specifically in AI, for example. The university can give them the foundation, can give them the theory, but it's not going to train them on the current the cutting edge tools that are being used currently, like what libraries are being used. You know, like TensorFlow, every 6 months you have a new version, you have a new update, right? That's one example. Imagine the number of papers going out every day in the AI field. Imagine the frameworks, the libraries, the tools, the architectures, you know. So it's really moving fast, and it's not the fault of the universities, but they cannot really keep up. And this is what we focus on at Zeka during our programs, is that we want to, you know, bridge this gap between what they take at university and what the market requires in terms of skills. And it's this addition, this gap that actually makes those students well, you know, positioned for the job market. And it's going to help the ecosystem flourish, because again, you're going to have more local skilled talent, you're going to have more companies hiring local skills and working on projects and, you know, kind of booming in the sector, because you're solving the number one issue, which is lack of talent.
On that note, following up on that, do you think the university that should change the foundation of what they offer to the student in the world that where everything are happening faster and faster? Perhaps the university should fall back and play the role of helping the student to be a critical thinker, how to solve problems, rather than focusing on the the latest tools in the market?
100%. I do believe that all the educational institutions, even schools, need to at least change some of the things that they're currently doing, because nothing actually changed in the way we learn in the last 100 years or maybe more. But if you look at our world and the way things are, it's completely changed. Like, especially the last 20 years with the introduction of the internet, the democratization of information, and with AI, it's exponentially growing at exponential rate, and everything is changing. So even the knowledge, like what you learn at university, let's say go back 100 years ago, you would learn something at university and it's going to serve you your whole career, because nothing is changing, right? The same information is more or less going to stay the same. Right now, everything we know right now is going to be obsolete in a couple of years, specifically technical skills, because things are moving really rapidly and new things are being added and technology is advancing and you have new research. So because of this change, so rapid change, you cannot really teach people exactly one thing and that's it. You're going to have to teach them how to learn, how to keep learning. And there's this thing called lifelong learning, right? So everything we know at the moment, again, we're going to have to relearn new things in five years or maybe 10 years time. So having this principle in mind, I believe educational institutions should educate the students not on the actual content, but rather on how to think and how to learn and how to relearn and how to, you know, what are the skills that they need to have that will last them 100 years instead of knowledge that's going to be obsolete in 5 years. So definitely they should change the way they approach. And I also think individuals should also know that just because, you know, you can't attend university for a couple of years and then expect to stop learning, my job is done. You should always be in learning mode. You should always be up to date with, you know, what's new, what's happening, what's the new advances in my field. Because again, it's not going to be the same. It's not static. It's super dynamic. It's changing very rapidly. And so stay in learning mode to stay relevant in the job market.
I was born and grew up in Asia, and I received my earlier education in Asia. And subsequently, I received my higher education in Australia. And there are two very different cultures in terms of approaching the education. I can see the pro and con in both sides of the world. For someone who lack of the knowledge and the background about the MENA region, what sort of approach or style would you say MENA region is similar to? Would that be more similar to the Asian style of education, or is it more similar to the Western style?
Okay, I'm not entirely sure, but I would say it depends on the countries. So we have some countries where it follows like the English education system. And so I would say it's more of on the Western. And what do you exactly mean by, let's say, Western versus Eastern education?
So the way that I look at it, more from my personal experience, is the Eastern world is probably focused a lot on the practice, memorization, getting a good grade. Obviously, the West also wants you to get a good grade, but perhaps not so much about practice of the question, but more encouraging about expressing yourself in that sort of way, rather than how to solve that problem exactly to get the good grade.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I understand your point. I don't exactly know over the whole region. Like, I think it depends from country to country and which educational system they follow. But I do know, for example, in Lebanon, it's more on the Eastern approach, where it's very hard system. We study three languages. Most Lebanese speak three languages: Arabic, French, and English. And our math and our, you know, STEM subjects are a bit advanced compared to others. And this is what I hear from all of my friends who maybe traveled and continued education abroad, I do believe we have more on the Eastern approach where, you know, study, take a lot of things, practice, instead of just doing it more flexibly, let's say. I can't say exactly the same for the rest of the region because I'm not really aware of the educational system there, but you might find similar to Lebanon, you might find something a bit closer to the Western. So it depends on which country you're talking about.
I found that super interesting that you just mentioned that most of the Lebanese have to learn three languages, i.e. Arabic, French, and English. For my personal experience, I can almost relate to that. So what I mean by that is for my first 6 years of the primary education, I did everything in Chinese. I learned everything, I spoke everything in Chinese. And then for the subsequent 6 years in the middle school and the high school, I did everything in Bahasa Malaysia or Malay. And then for my university, I did everything in English. So it's almost like I have to switch from one thing to another thing. And to some extent, sometimes I have to relearn a couple of things again because they are entirely different, alien to me if I don't try to. Is that a similar experience for you or for the Lebanese when you were describing that three languages, or it is not like that?
It's not really like that. So, it depends on which. So in Lebanon, we have two school systems. We have the French system and the English education system. But most people, historically, I think it was more of the French system. So a lot of the people used to go to French schools, and the French schools, we are taught French from a very early age, French and Arabic, and then also English as well. But it's not like the main language spoken in school was French. So all the subjects were taught in French, and also with some English courses and, of course, Arabic courses. And whereas the English education system, the main language is the English, right? So there's no French in those schools. But the majority of schools in Lebanon are French-based schools. So that's why most of the Lebanese people do speak three languages. And same thing at university, but not as much. So universities in Lebanon, they're like maybe 50-50. So you have some, maybe less. I think you would have like 20-30% that are French-based, where we speak French in class. And the majority is maybe English-based because, you know, English is more common nowadays. And education in English is more common as well. So, yeah, I would say this is the way... The way it is, but you have to know something also that Lebanese language, even the Arabic language of Lebanese, it's a mixture of English and Arabic and French, right? Because you interact on a day-to-day basis with a lot of people and in different languages, when you talk Lebanese Arabic, it's not the same as the, let's say, Arabic of other people. Not only because it's a different dialect or different pronunciation, but also because we do use a lot of the lexicon, a lot of the words that are coming from French or from English in our day-to-day. For example, everyone says bonjour in Lebanon, which is a French word for hello. And even if anyone in Lebanon, you just go in and say bonjour, no one's look at you like, why are you talking French? It's an Arabic, it's a Lebanese word in a way.
Right. I did a study exchange during the uni to France, so I did try to pick up some French in the old days, but not much of the success. I think one thing that I still curious to know is when I was explaining or sharing my experience, part of that is also where when I was learning maths, I was learning maths and science in Chinese, and then subsequently I was learning maths and science in Malay, and then again I repeat the whole thing in English. So it could be really challenging to switch in especially those scientific terms and all of those things. That these days I tend to think a lot more just in the English term. So I think that is where I come from. That being said, when you have two so distinctive languages throughout from primary to middle school to high school to university, one in French while the other in English, how do you get the people who come from two different schools to talk to each other, especially in the business setting there?
I mean, everyone speaks Lebanese, right? So that's at least a common ground. And okay. As I said, most of the French educated students speak English as well. The opposite is not the same. So most of the English speaking students do not speak French. And so usually we speak English or Lebanese and everyone understands. And if you speak French, then you can also speak French with the people who understand French.
But, right. Okay.
You know, it's the mixture. So that's why I said that the Lebanese language incorporates English and French words, because it's maybe because of people trying to communicate together from different backgrounds. So eventually we ended up creating this language that incorporates those words, you know, and as well.
That is so fascinating. Now, if the world wants to learn more about what the MENA region has got to offer with AI, what is the best place for them to start exploring?
Maybe check out Zaka and follow what we're doing. I'm not aware of a main place to check out the AI advancements or anything in MENA. There's a lot of maybe publications that share news or startup news in the MENA, like Magnet, like Wamda. So these are some websites that people can check out to learn about the ecosystem, startup ecosystem in the region. But it's not purely focused on AI. If we're looking for AI related news, this is what we're trying to also to fill this void. So hopefully check out Zaka and you should find the information.
Certainly, I'll make sure to put the website of Zaka on the website so people can find out more. Now, to finish up this podcast interview, these are my two usual questions. Number one, what is your most important first principle?
Can you explain that a bit more?
Most important first principle, like for example, you think that is so important for you as a core value. So for example, maybe I'll take myself. For me, I think my first principle is to always understand what is the root of the problem before trying to solve them. So rather than trying to say, okay, here's the problem and this is how we should solve it, I think the similar analogy is the Toyota 5Y. So I keep asking why until we really, really find out the root of the problem. So that for me is one of my most important first principles.
Okay, I see. I mean, I definitely do agree with you on you know, like if you get asking exactly understanding the problem before solving it, because understanding the problem actually is 50% of solving the problem. It's like half of the work is actually understanding why. If I want to think of what would be my own maybe first principle, it would be, let me think. Maybe, I don't know if it's a first principle, but it's how I usually approach problems. Because usually problems are not as simple as like small steps. So it's usually a big problem. So what I would do is I would just try to break it down and then tackle the first one, the first, what's the next thing I should do? And then tackle it one by one. And this makes basically big problems end up being small problems that you face, that you solve easily, right? Step by step, and then eventually work your way towards solving the big one. And so maybe I break down your problems and tackle, okay, what's the next thing I need to do? And then it's going to become clear how to solve the next one. And this is something I think a lot of people, maybe they get confused or scared when they facing a big problem, like, okay, how do I tackle whatever X? And they think it's such a big thing that there's no way for me to actually solve it. But what they don't know is if you just focus on the next thing you can do, do that, and then it's going to become clear what the next step is. So take it step by step, and eventually you're going to solve it.
Wonderful. Final question is, what is one book that you have read and thought it would have been better for your younger self to have?
There's a lot of these books, actually, because I started reading... yeah, I know. But I started reading books really like after I graduated university, so which is something I regret. I wish I started earlier. But the thing about, you know, the school system is they kind of force you to read books that you don't like, so you end up hating reading. But actually, reading books is a great thing, right? So I wish I had like in general. But if I want to pick one book, one of my favorite books is actually called "Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman," which is talking about the life of Richard Feynman. So I don't know if you know Richard Feynman, but he's an American physicist and a Nobel Prize winner, and he's a very interesting person. For me, I really admire his whole career, his whole life. And what I like about him the most is that he's a very smart person, but in a way that's actually practical smart, not the book smart. And so the way he used to say, for example, he's not the kind of person that would just memorize words or understand the concept. He was like, okay, how does this actually work? Like, let me just break it down. Let me try to understand how it works. And so he started with physics, and then he started solving biology problems and like random things, right? Because he's very interested in how things work actually, practically. And I would really like, admire his character and the way he approaches life, because he lived like a full life, in my opinion. He was someone who's working in physics, very interesting advanced quantum physics problem. He's also a bongo player, and he played music, and he danced, and he painted, and you know, so he went into the art and the science and kind of the full round aspect of life. And all because he was a curious person who was interested in figuring out life and how everything worked, and doing it by himself, right? So he would just break things down, understand how they work, build them right up, and then having this intuition about life. And so, I've read this book like many times, and it's always a funny, interesting book to read.
Love it. I should have to check it out. I think I found a book. I have tagged you in the document. I'll just double check if that is the one. Thank you so much, Chris, for dialing in the early morning to share with us your experience about the AI education in the MENA region. I certainly have picked up so many things, and I really appreciate your sharing.
Thank you, Jason, for having me. It was a pleasure, and hope to have it again.